I'm Jim DeBacchus on the left.
And I'm Greg Hughes on the right.
And I'm Natalie Gochner in the productive middle, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. Today we'll discuss political earthquakes in Washington, D.C., and literal earthquakes in Utah. We'll wrap up what's going on in Utah politics. And what's all the talk about Hillary Clinton? But first, this news. I'm Natalie Gochner, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle, a lively and informative conversation about politics and issues facing the state of Utah. I represent the political center. I'm joined on the left by State Senator Jim DeBacchus. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, Natalie.
And on the right by State Representative Greg Hughes. Welcome, Greg.
Good morning, Natalie.
We have a great program for you today. We're going to talk in the next hour about some exciting things, but there was an earthquake in the political world in Virginia, Eric Cantor, and I'm real excited to talk about that, and we're going to ask Greg to break it down. But before we do that, I want to talk a little bit about the earthquake that hit Utah last night. Davis County, I don't remember, some 10 miles east of Bountiful was the epicenter, and we had a 3.3 on the Richter scale earthquake. I wonder if that was a reaction to what was happening on the East Coast politically, Greg.
That's what I think. I think that we felt literally the reverberations of the political shifts that happened back east. You know, is this the big one? Was this the one we all had to worry about?
Can
we just say 3.3? We're done here. Okay, talk to us in another 1,000 years. We've had our big moment. I want to believe that that's the case.
Jim's going to have some great commentary for us on this, but he handed me a piece of paper that kind of described a worst case scenario for an earthquake. Do you mind if I just kind of share that, Jim? Jim can tell us the source of this, but scientists say a worst case scenario quake in Utah would be centered in mid Salt Lake Valley and would be felt in seconds from Brigham City in the north to Santaquin in the south, and it would also be affected from Tooele to Colville. Shaking in Salt Lake County would be so severe that no one would be able to stand without falling. Unsecured hot water heaters would shake loose in many homes. Gas lines would start fires. It also talks about a ledge that would form on Highland Drive and along Wasatch Boulevard, a 3-foot gap. I mean, this was pretty scary stuff, Jim.
They happen, according to the Seismological Center at the U, every 1,300 years. We are about 1,340 years over, not overdue, but since the last one. Luckily, we're saved by the margin. There's a 670 plus or minus.
Excellent, excellent. Love statistics.
The margin of error.
So that is the range. And of course, it's going to happen. And when you start imagining what, Natalie, what you just described, which is kind of officially the way it's going to go, we really need to begin to look at preparing. And I get the sense, never mind the Japanese, I'm not sure we're as prepared as California is, because we don't have the fortune of having a lot of kind of middle and earthquakes that get us reminded all the time about this big quake. In the legislature over the last 10 years, there has been Larry Wiley, who has been standing out there screaming, we need a survey of every single school in the state of Utah, and we need the money to see how bad it's going to be. The legislature, in its wisdom, is saying, you know what, we don't want to touch that. We don't want to know, because as soon as we know, as soon as parents know that there's a 93% chance that their entire school will collapse and every kid will be killed, then it's going to be $500, $600, $700 million, $1 billion to fix the schools. But it's an issue that we ought to at least bring out of the closet and say, just like we did with the Capitol, when we threw all the dough in there to protect that in case an earthquake went during the session, we probably need to go back and bite the bullet on every school in the state and at least do the survey.
Yeah. You know, I remember when they did the Capitol, having a tour where we actually climbed in a pretty small area underneath the Capitol to see where they had cut the foundation from where it was and put it on the rolling kind of foundation. I don't know if either of you got to do that, but it was pretty chilling to see, you know, what it takes to make something so it's earthquake ready. And we obviously need a lot to, we have a lot to do in this state.
There's an observation window now. I do tours with scouts and with youth groups around the Capitol, particularly during the session, and there's a window that you can look and see those stabilizers
that hold the
foundation up. And the theory is, untested, that the ground can move as much as 2 feet in any direction, and the Capitol would not move. I think the big bellwether for this was when the LDS Church started making everything earthquake-proof, mm-hmm. the tabernacle, everything else. I think that was the cue mm-hmm. that the rest of us
yeah,
took.
You gotta
is there
so.
A pipeline here?
If
does somebody
Church
know
is...
something we don't know? Let's get going. So
wait a minute. I give those tours of the Capitol, too. You're saying those big, round things.
Those are rubber.
They're not trash can compactors?
No. They're not places yeah. that we throw the Democrat bills upon. Their defeat. No, Jim, they're not.
Sorry for everybody who's taking a tour with me.
Let's save our discussion about Eric Cantor and the earthquake in Washington for the second segment. And let's talk a little bit this segment about local politics. What's going on? What are we seeing? And we can, you know, do the fun kind of speculative things or the hard things. I think a hard thing is that there's a lot of people that believe that the indictments, excuse me, on the John Swallow, mismanagement are imminent. Any time now that we might see Jason Powers, that we might see John Swallow, that we might see our former Attorney General
Mark Shurtleff
served with indictments.
Well, I'll tell you what, former Attorney General Mark Shurtleff has said publicly that he expects to be indicted, but he also expects to be found not guilty of any charges that would be put forward. You know what? It's an ugly time right now to think that your last two Attorney Generals. Might be served or indicted. It's just something that you don't want to see. And I don't care what party that is. I think that just it deflates people when they look at their public servants.
Jim, we saw some sort of mention about Mike Lee somehow getting pulled into this with some of this money trail. Tell me your read on that.
So the father of this whole mess, Jeremy Johnson, says that he was asked by John Swallow to put $50,000 in cash into a pot and then go collect another $50,000 in cash from other people, then take that $100,000 and go to people and give them the cash and get back checks for Mike Lee's campaign for the Senate. And the reason that's necessary is because there's a limitation on how much money you can put in a federal Senate race. This is a tough situation for Mike Lee because this isn't a he said, she said, no, I said it, no, I didn't. Because if it's true, there's a pile of $100,000 and there are a number of people that are going to have the FBI knock on their door and they're going to say, did somebody write you a check? Did you write a check for somebody? Yes or no? And while politicians may lie to the FBI and lawyers might, you start knocking on 15 doors of just normal political operatives, and probably they're going to be telling the truth. So that's a pretty easy thing to check or not check. And I suspect that if it's true, and Jeremy Johnson, for all of his crimes, has proven to be a pretty accurate when it comes right down to following up on what he said. If all of that is true, this shows a level of kind of contempt for the law that just seems pervasive through our entire system.
Tricky stuff. Greg?
Let me just say, and I know we're coming up on our break, here's the problem. I worried at first about all these people sitting in jail cells that have a lot to say. And someone gave me a saying, and I think it's true. When you make a deal in hell, you've got devils for witnesses. And so I actually find a little bit more credibility with some of the people that are coming forward now, understanding that what's going on. But can't we just agree that the real problem where you're trying to funnel money and you're trying to give money to other people to give then to a campaign – these limits or so-called limits of participation in political campaigns are ridiculous. They were set at a time after the Nixon reelection. You could have bought an automobile for the amount that you could participate in a federal election. Those numbers have never changed. And the circuitous route of dollars into campaigns now is a full-blown joke. And I know it happens more than the silver bullets that we watch go by when people get caught doing it. It's got to be happening every day. Just quit with limits, make everything disclosable, make it online. The moment you give, it is available for the public to scrutinize. That's a policy problem that I think begs for this type of skullduggery.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner. I'm joined by Greg Hughes and Jim DeBacchus. Join us in a few minutes and we'll talk about the Eric Cantor debate.
I'm Jim DeBacchus on the left.
And I'm Greg Hughes on the right.
And I'm Natalie Gochner in the productive middle, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. Before we jump into the Eric Cantor issue, let's just run off a couple more kind of local political things. Who are you guys hearing might be an intra-party challenge to Governor Herbert? It's starting to get to the point where we're going to start to see these people and know who they are.
Jonathan Johnson is CEO of Overstock.com. He has been very active in local politics, state issues. He is ramping up, undoubtedly, for a race for the governor's seat.
So that'll be a serious intra-party. Any others you're hearing, Greg?
The Speaker of the House, our first female Speaker of the House, Becky Lockhart. She has not made anything official. However, she has kept all options open. She is not seeking another term and is not looking to be Speaker again. And there will be 2 years of productive public policy, I'm sure, and involvement on local level. And I think she's a viable candidate to challenge the governor in an inter-party race.
I think Herbert really likes his job, but I do often wonder if he and the people around him are thinking about how difficult a third term is. And I realize it's not quite a third term for him, kind of a fragmented path, but third terms are tough. Jim, what would you add here?
Yeah, I think that's the key question. Is Governor Herbert going to run again? And I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I doubt he knows. When does he have to make that decision?
I mean, I think he said he'll be doing it in November, December kind of time frame. Am I right in that? Greg's
nodding.
Yeah,
I've heard that once he's going to have some events, and I think very soon he's going to make his political future known. He's actually said this. Here's the deal. Gubernatorial politics are different than legislative politics. I think that lawmakers come in, and we want to get some things done. We want to put our fingerprints on this process.
And then you go back to your private sector
and then
job.
We get back to our job. We live with the laws we write, with the budgets we pass. The gubernatorial politics is this. I want to be reelected. I like the job. I want to be popular. How are you popular? Don't offend anyone. How do you not offend anyone? Don't do anything. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say that's specific to any governor. I'm telling you that is the case in gubernatorial politics. And if you can raise $1 million in a gala and you can keep everyone happy by being, you know, by not really, you know, rattling any sabers, I don't know how you don't get reelected.
We love our governors.
Yeah,
I don't think
even all these inter-party challenges, I don't think they're successful outside of your base, because I think people go, It's not offending me. Why do I want to change?
Two other quick stories I saw. I saw a story that Mia Love, if elected, would be the lone Republican member of the Congressional Black Caucus. That was quite a thought.
True.
That's a fit right in.
That's like a Democrat caucus in Utah. I mean, that's a lonely place.
Lonely
you could
place.
Have a phone booth for a caucus room.
And then there, I saw another article that, close confidence to our former governor, Mike Leavitt, have told Bob Burnick that Leavitt will not be a candidate in 2016. Any reaction to that, you guys?
I wholly reject it. I am 100% convinced. Book it. Mark it. He is a candidate for the United States Senate in 2016. You cannot convince me otherwise.
Could we be so lucky, Jim?
Well, he's got the names. He's got the list now from Count My Vote. So it may not be Mike Leavitt, but I'm sure that Mike Leavitt machine will be there, and we'll have their candidates and throw all of that behind somebody or other.
Yeah. All right. Well, so let's go back to...
You didn't say.
What do you want me to add, Greg?
Do you think he's running,
you know,
yes or no? Former staffer?
I think Mike Leavitt is an amazing leader, that is once-in-a-generation kind of leader for this state. And I think he could do just amazing things anywhere he goes. Those close to him will tell you that he's a chief executive, not a legislator. And there is a difference. You mentioned a difference between Senate races and gubernatorial races. He likes to run an enterprise. You could become a senator.
He's a Trekkie?
Yeah. Tyler, our producer, Tyler, will you take those rose-colored glasses off of Natalie? This is just, I mean.
You become a senator, you're just one of 100 people, and you have this little staff. But he likes to run an operation. He is a chief executive in the truest sense of the word. That's a governor. That's a president. That's not in the legislative branch. These guys are all offended.
Natalie, Greg, let me turn to you on this. Why wouldn't Natalie run?
Oh, now,
take
guys.
Take that whole Leavitt machine that's all set up.
I think you're right.
Knows policy as good as anybody. Knows.
I got to get her out of that. I got to get her off of that fence she likes to sit on. That whole middle thing. That whole middle thing is just like lukewarm. Well, we got to get her over here on the right.
It's 'cause she's a girl, and they don't think of themselves in those terms.
Yeah, she doesn't want to be.
If she was a man,
the truth is, I'm better at policy than I am at politics.
Well, who isn't?
You have been untested on the politics side. We have to find out.
All right. Well, let's jump to Eric Cantor and what happened. I mean, I'm working at my desk, and I see this news flash from the Washington Post that Eric Cantor was unsuccessful in his bid in the primary. And I just thought it was an error. It's just one of those things that I did not believe. I heard someone characterize this as campaign malpractice. I mean, this is a guy that just blew it, whether it was his hubris, whatever it was, but wow. And Greg, you can break this down for us.
Okay, so since we've had leadership positions within our U.S. Congress, the majority leader has never been defeated in America's history in an inter-party race. This is the first time it's ever happened. Eric Cantor had over $5 million in his campaign account. He spent well over $1 million in ads and in a campaign for this primary. His opponent spent $200,000. They had internal polling that had them up as much as 34%. He lost by 10%. This was not even
a
narrow. This wasn't even a narrow defeat. This was a drubbing that he took. I'll tell you what. I've looked at this. First, lightning will strike. You will look, and 9.9 times out of 10, the mother's milk of a successful campaign are resources. Mm-hmm. And if you have the resources, particularly in the advantage that Eric Cantor had, you can't lose. Mm-hmm. There is a rare occasion where that'll be different. There's also so you're going to have that element every in rare instances. But here's another challenge that this primary had. Eric Cantor, during redistricting, wanted a very, very conservative district. Maybe too conservative in hindsight. Yeah. But it was also an open primary, and there were people like the guy from the Dukes of Hazzard, Cooter. Mm-hmm. His name is Ben something. He's a Democrat congressman. He was actively in that congressional district encouraging Democrats to vote for Eric Cantor's opponent. In an open primary, I think he got hit by the extreme right, and I think by very savvy, organized Democrats. Even then, it was a long shot, but I think that you had and I think that his campaign and their polling obviously was incompetent.
So I'm sitting here in the political middle, and I'm just thinking that the Republican Party has just sent another huge mixed message out there. Jim, are you happy about this or sad?
I'm happy.
As you should be, sir.
I'm happy. We might even win that seat. The war going on in the Republican Party almost guarantees that the Democrats are going to win the presidency. I don't know about November. It gets different when you fight in 435 skirmishes. But what is the Republican Party? Is it Ken Ivory or is it Rob Bishop on public lands? On immigration, is it the Utah Compact or is it the opposite?
Utah County Republican Party.
Yeah,
the way they took on immigration.
Where is the soul there? And they don't know. That's what the issue is.
I'll give Democrats credit, and I was saying this before we did the show. You can have Democrats who philosophically and on public policy disagree with one another. Unions and their dependence on fossil fuels mm-hmm. to run the engines of this economy can stand shoulder to shoulder with an environmentalist who wants to do away with that very engine or fossil fuels to go against Republicans. Republicans create circular firing squads constantly, challenging each other's credentials, challenging each other's conservative or philosophical approach. It happens all the time, and I'll tell you, I don't know if that's because Republicans are more committed to the things they believe, and and that means something, and they're willing to test it. Democrats see a common enemy, and they're ready to rally. It's a problem. This race does send mixed messages. It is going to be very hard for Speaker Boehner to run the upcoming Congress with what's going on.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner, and I'm joined by Jim DeBacchus and Greg Hughes. Let's transition from the Cantor misfire to Hillary Clinton. And we have seen her now. She's got her book coming out. She's been doing some very strategic interviews. You can just feel the national PR campaign starting to build for this woman to make the run. Jim? Is this, you're wearing an Obama cap in the studio, I notice. Are you going to be a Hillary Clinton supporter? Is it a done deal that she runs? Is that a good thing for our country?
No. She's a little too conservative for me. I think she's
starting to like her more.
Keep
she's
going.
A little too quick to jump into wars. She's definitely a hawk. Doesn't see anything wrong with a lot more military spending. I hope that the Democrats will find somebody on the left, Elizabeth, from Massachusetts, perhaps.
He's been. This I is know. The third there, program in a row where she's gotten a call out, if I've got this right.
There will be, there needs to be some pressure, or Hillary will be over there in Jason Chaffetz territory. That's where her natural instincts go. And I hope that there's a fight here, and that she gets pulled more to where most mainstream Democrats are.
Wouldn't that be amazing for this country to go from the first African-American president to the first woman, you know, female president? Greg, are you a Hillary Clinton fan?
So here's the deal. We had a show a while back where I pointed out that she had been under medical care for well over a month, and remember the glasses and everything else, and what that suggests in terms of brain trauma. Had a great listener who called me out on this, saying she was not in any hospital for a month. And so I'd started going through the press clippings of that, and certainly she was under
he was doing
medical
due diligence.
Well, it was a great email.
After he said it,
it was a great email, and but she was certainly under medical supervision. She had doctors at home and everything, which most of us wouldn't be able to do. But the point was this: she is a very well packaged candidate. She has had things happen. I mean, all that. I think the whole point of that issue was, if she wasn't that badly hurt or injured or under medical care, then she should have been in front of Congress talking about Benghazi, which she wasn't able to do. Now she's saying, when they say, do you want to run for president? She says, I want to be a grandma. I am having my first child, and I'm just so excited to be
she
a grandma.
Is smooth,
that is
isn't
disingenuous. That is just not an authentic, real answer. You know what you're doing. You're on a book tour, for heaven's sake.
Oh, imagine that.
So here's the deal. I will tell you that I think that the Republicans can certainly do better for a candidate for president. For the reasons that Jim has pointed out, I think that she is a viable candidate on the Democrat side, because she does pay attention to national security, which I think is one of the bigger issues that a president ought to. She gave the best answer on the whole prisoner of war, the Bergdahl exchange of prisoners, and I thought it was brilliant. She said, do those five Al-Qaeda operatives pose a risk? Not to this country. They do not. But they do to Afghanistan. They do to Syria. And those countries better start getting serious about their own security. And our soldiers shouldn't sit in prisons because they don't. I thought that was actually a very reasonable answer. I thought that was about the best answer I've heard. I've not heard that from the administration articulated that way. And I thought, you know what? That would have a mainstream appeal if you said that more.
Another mainstream appeal is who the buzz is on who Hillary will pick as the vice president.
Interesting. Yeah. And maybe John a couple Huntsman? Of names. Throw out a couple of names and we'll go to gripes.
That's it. John Huntsman.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting. And will Huntsman Sr. buy the Tribune, Jim?
No, that is not the way it's going to go down. That's the way
you
that
heard it here first.
The Deseret News is is playing it. There's seven or eight people that are interested in buying the Tribune. He's one of many. And probably won't end up with John Huntsman.
Let's go to gripes. Greg?
Here's my gripe. We just talked about national security. I think that the condition in this world is pretty scary right now. You've got Putin and Russia doing it basically anything they want to do. You've got now the unrest going on in Iraq. I know all the Bush haters just could not wait for that cowboy to get out of his second term and leave the Oval Office. Can any of us agree that the world was a little safer when we had a cowboy in that White House? I'm telling you, I miss the stability around the planet that a strong United States foreign policy presented. I think we were safe. I think we had all those years of safety and peace after 9/11, and we took it for granted. And I'm tired of all the anti-Bush people. Democrats still complain about Bush. Into the second term of Obama, it's still Bush's fault. I miss George W. Bush.
Jim, a call out for Bush 43.
I got to change my whole thing now. That was the most preposterous thing I've ever heard Greg Hughes say, and that covers a lot of territory.
Yes, it does.
Wishing for the days of all the Bush wars.
Oh.
You know, let's get 100,000, 200,000 in Iraq. Let's get the veterans.
You pushed his button.
Get out there. We're going to start a war in Afghanistan while we're at it. Let's start rattling the saber. Thank goodness that man is in Texas, where his damage is limited to a bunch of brush around his ranch.
Very good. Well, my gripe, I had to kind of debate my gripe a little bit because, you know, it's the start of the World Cup today. Last night was like Christmas Eve in the Gochner home. I've got my jerseys ready to wear. I'm just so excited. Just for the record, I'm predicting Germany and Argentina in the final. which is a little out there because everyone thinks it's going to be Brazil. But and I was going to gripe about people like you that don't like soccer.
Yeah,
Jim
and
Greg.
I'd be one of those. For
but
sure.
But you know, I'm going to stay with the Hillary Clinton theme. And you know, here I am, a woman who believes passionately in getting more women in decision making roles. And you know, Jim pointed out she's too conservative for Jim, so she's, you know, she's maybe more
so
in the moderate category. I'm
yeah.
still more conservative than Hillary. But I just got to tell you that every time I see her, she looks different. Her hair changes every photo op. And so if I were the PR person helping to position her campaign, I would get a look and stay with it.
Absolutely.
What do you guys think? Fair enough.
Sometimes she just looks like she's just letting go, you know, and then other times she looks like a million bucks. I can't keep track.
You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner. I represent the Political Center. On the left has been Jim DeBacchus, and on the right, Greg Hughes. The program is produced by Tyler Ford. Thanks for listening.